that much about Islam. They have some Islamic teachings. They follow them. They do not want their kids to be that involved with Islam. How should we treat this issue?
So let's clarify the circumstances first. Are you talking about an Islamic country or a non-Islamic country?
Yeah.
Islamic country, for example.
Islamic country. A person who lives in an Islamic country and majority of the people who are in that society are Muslims or not Muslims?
Naturally, they are Muslims.
We're looking at the, let's say, priority of those whose kids are going to be in these schools. So the majority. The majority of those who are living here,
let's take that logic, dear doctor, and then apply it in a secular society as in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What would the answer then be?
Then we cannot decide the curriculum as Muslims in a country where, of course, they don't believe in Islam. So we need to start somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to our own schools, then I have a responsibility towards these children, whether their parents are like it or not. So I'm going to tell the parents of these children, look, we have these different fields of knowledge, and we're going to study these different classes and these books. If you don't like it, you have your own free will to find another school. But when your child is in our school, I don't care what you teach them at home. This is what they're being taught here in our school.
Sheikh, let me answer the brother, because he was talking about an Islamic country. And Iran can be one of those targets of the question that the brother raised, right? Look, when I'm talking about the majority, I mean to be included in the curriculum. But then again, there is no force and enforcement to have the students to follow for those who are not interested. There are some schools that they are not offering, for example, religious studies still, even in Tehran now.
Right.
And they actually, instead, they have some ethics books, and they actually have replaced them with these ethics, and it is
okay. Which ethics books, if I might ask?
Something about general ethics, what is good and what is bad. Though it is, again, rooted in Islam, in religions, but they want satisfy themselves that, okay, we're not going to study, and we are not interested in the Islamic studies. And moreover, for those who are not interested, the subject of Islamic studies is not something which is mandatory in their reports, right?
Right.
So again, they have this freedom to have that. But bring it back to your first question, then invest. Are they really behaving people like that and treating people like that, like in a country like France? So they are forcing you not to study religion.
Even Denmark, where we're from, like we know it, like we've seen it, we experienced it. I want
to reach to this comparison. Yeah,
there's parts of the curriculum which is values that they believe is the truth, and they present it as the absolute truth: freedom of speech, democracy.
Reality.
Of course, there's liberal freedom, like ideas of liberalism, which is being promoted as the absolute truth in our schools. And if you don't accept it, it's as if, like, okay, then you accept a dictatorship, for example. You're an enemy of the state, basically, if you don't accept democracy. So I think that every society works on actually promoting the values that they found truthful. So I don't think that Muslims should be different, right? Right. We actually have proof why our values are the truth, right? So in contrary to, like... Right. Like these ideas, these liberal ideas, which can't be proven, which are contradicts with each other. So I think it's very important for us, like, not to be so scared or sensitive because of the secular movements that exist out there, and to be like, look, this is our religion. Of course, we're going to teach it to our children, right? So when I said philosophical thinking, just not to be misunderstood, basically what I said is not philosophical thinking, what we understand from the Islamic seminary. Like you teach philosophy, mawjood bima huwa mawjood, and then you discuss philosophy. That's not what I mentioned. No, the fact that they can actually think for themselves. For example, if you want to discuss philosophical thinking for children, how do you do that? Contemplate, we have it in the narrations, contemplate over the different blessings that Allah has given you. So if a teacher can make a child contemplate over what he's been blessed with, for example, I've been blessed with good parents, God, he gives me this, he gives me that, that's philosophical thinking, because he's contemplating this young person. And that's normally something which we are a lot of the times, unfortunately, we are being deprived of in other countries. Why? Because children, they are being forced into, for example, accepting games, following their desires, their worldly desires, which normally prevents them from actually having this ability to think philosophically, to contemplate and think.
So dear Sheikh, you would say that in Western societies or with Islamic communities present, we should teach them about Islamic rulings. Islamic teachings generally.
As the doctor he mentioned, I think it's important to emphasize on that Islamic lifestyle.
Because
that encompasses like all the different aspects and not only one certain aspect. Because just teaching rulings to a person that don't understand why he should follow those rulings, it's not going to be beneficial.
He has no conviction to follow.
Exactly, right? He's not going to feel... He's not going to feel responsible when it comes to these rulings, right? He's not going to feel obligated. So you have to understand Islam as a package. That's why Allama Tabatabai rahmatullahi alayhi, when he defines Islam, he says it's a lifestyle. It's a lifestyle that leads you to the absolute perfection towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Everything that can help to with that goal or for you to reach that goal, that will be considered as a part of Islam. Let's say, for example, working out, going to the gym. If you do it with the sake of, for example, reaching Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala by being healthy and therefore doing your responsible, your religious duties, that becomes an ibadah for yourself, right? That's become a part of Islam, actually.
Then let me pose this question. We agree that religion should be taught, at least Islamic religion, Islamic teachings. What about religion in general? Should we also provide a curriculum where we talk about religion in general, Christianity, Judaism?
For the followers of different religions, it is a must.
Right.
Yeah.
And even in our country, we have provided, for example, the scholars of Ahl Sunnah have provided the books for the Sunni students here in this country, Christians, Jews, and they have written the books, and they are the official books of the Ministry of Education of country.
But doesn't that lead to problems between the different religions in the country? If perhaps
no, they need to follow. Because we're not after changing the people's religion. We want there to be actually to be adhering to their own beliefs. So we want this freedom of studying their own religions. Mm. So this is what is being practiced here, and we want the same to happen in the West.
So
they talk about liberty and liberal,
but then they only teach liberalism.
We're forced to like not accepting Islam or stand by Islamic values, and I agree on that.
Sheikh, I had a guest from one of the Southeast Asian countries. He came to meet us here in Qom, and when I took him to the bookshops and
bookstores,
he was astonished that when he saw that Sahih Bukhari is available in our bookstores. He said, "Oh, it's possible! How come we cannot find even a single book of Shia in our country? But here."
You can find Minhaj al-Sunnah.
Minhaj al-Sunnah. Like, here, you can find it.
You can find the life biography of Michelle Obama. I saw on
Michelle Obama. Yeah, I saw that as well.
What?
So a Christian, a Jewish scholar is writing the book based on their own beliefs for their students. So this is the meaning of liberty is going to be interpreted.
But doctor, the problem is what then if we have an author or a sect or a religion who is directly adverse to our beliefs and teachings.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have books and they also sell these books and they also present here also in Qom.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And people read these books. Isn't that a huge problem? Doesn't that lead to corruption? Because you have I know teenagers, Muslims, who like they read these books and then they developed this relation and these beliefs that intermingle with Islam and directly clash with Islam.
Mm-hmm.
So shouldn't we also censor some of these books?
Yeah, this is a good discussion about censorship, whether we should be like completely liberal when it comes to these ideas. So I think we should distinguish between political movements, like people that are using these ideas and theories to ruin the social cohesion in a society. That's one part. That's one discussion for itself. But people know they're only explaining. That's the only thing that they do. I think that you need to have discussions and you need to, reply to some of the arguments they come with, right?
Right.
Argue why your belief is the right and why they're wrong. Because just censoring people doesn't make their ideas disappear, right? True. So the ideas are going to stay. So you need to explain why their ideas are wrong. If you believe that they're false and they're harmful for a person or for a society,
so
you need to explain it. You don't have to censor it. But when it starts a political movement and they're starting to ruin the social coexistence or the cohesion in a country or in a society, definitely, I think that that's the responsibility of the state to take action here.
Sheikh, correct me if I am wrong, but
I want to go one step back behind where the Sheikh said. Look, when we are talking about Islamic religion, not every religion's book is going to be allowed in the society. For example, in public, even for the use of the kids. Look, Abrahamic religions I'm talking about, they are allowed to have.
only Abrahamic religions. Because yeah, I mean, already you've censored some religions.
The religions which are being accepted worldwide by all the people, so not man-made religions.
What about Hinduism?
Look, we are talking even Abrahamic religion in every part of the world. They have good coexistence with each other, and they had it from before, and they had no problem. Even the books and the sources.
I agree, and I accept that. So you should say the Abrahamic religions, they should be united, but Hinduism, Buddhism, and Shintoism, we should leave that out.
Definitely.
Yeah, so I think there's a difference between accepting them having their books or letting the knowledge being available and actively promoting these ideas or teaching children these ideas. I think there's a difference between the two. Of course, I would never go home and teach my child ideas that I know would confuse the person.
Like, but imagine, dear Sheikh, you go home and you find your child, your son, who's grown up, reading a book about Hinduist teachings because he found it at a shop at a discount.
That's completely fine. I wouldn't prevent him from doing so. I would explain why it's wrong.
Ah, but you would explain why it is wrong.
Yeah, definitely.
Right. And here's the problem. We do not have that explainer of why it is wrong. We only have these books freely available and people buy them and read them and eat them up.
Yeah. So, yeah. And that's the thing that, so that goes back, that's a criticism which I believe that is, needs to be pointed towards like students of the Islamic seminary. That's very important. People that study Islamic studies, they should work within these fields and make sure that the knowledge is available, or at least give an answer from an Islamic perspective or viewpoint on these subjects. But I don't think censorship is the way to deal with these things. On one hand, second, if it's a political movement, that's a discussion for itself. If they are causing harm to the security in a country where they're developing ideas as a group and so on and so forth, then that's different.
Closing comment, Dr.
Ali. Yeah, what I mentioned actually about the Abrahamic religion and their liberty and having their own books for their own kids' education, it was in the level of countrywide, not in a specific or limited level. Moreover, as for those other followers of religions, you said other religions that you have been talking about and mentioned. So to the extent that the person has a good, let's say, power to criticize and to read critically the book, it's okay. And if he has no power and to no enlightenment or power to distinguish between what is good or bad based on the verdicts of the scholars, so it is forbidden to read those books.
But we are helping by providing these books. We're not distinguishing who can buy them.
I told you, at least in this country, we're not actually providing them the books because... But this censorship is not, again, in the sense that you are talking about. Look, for example, the schools, Indian schools in Tehran, they have these books of Buddhism.
In their communities, of course.
Their own communities. Yeah, they are all okay to follow their own religions.
I would love to continue this discussion, but we are unfortunately out of time. I thank the dear Dr. Ali Aulian for joining us and for providing us with insightful knowledge. And also thank the dear Sheikh Mohammed Khani for joining us and contributing to this fruitful discussion.
Thank you so much.
Finally, I thank the dear listeners for tuning in. Until next time, fi amanillah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest night, shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, or you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, congratulations on birth anniversary of Hazrat Ali Akbar and the Youth Day. Now, it's time to listen to a short speech by Hujjat al-Islam Dr. Shomali. He's going to talk about what the youth should do for the coming of Imam Mahdi. May God hasten his coming.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The topic which has been suggested for today is what the youths should do for preparation for coming of Imam Mahdi Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. It is very interesting that there is something between Imam Mahdi Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif and youths which is special. When we read the hadith, it says that great majority of helpers of Imam Mahdi are young people. There would be some older people, maybe middle-aged and old, but it's like salt in food. So if you make food, the majority of food is rice, meat, you know, other things, vegetables. There is little salt. So, majority of the helpers of Imam Mahdi Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif are young people, but of course those old people are there to give their wise ideas, to support, to help. But because this mission needs perhaps, this is my understanding, needs lots of activities, lots of work, and also needs, to be fresh and to be dynamic and vibrant, and maybe also to relate to the other youths of the world. So most of the helpers of Imam Mahdi Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif would be young people. Even Imam himself, when people see him, he looks young. But young here can mean some 30 years old, because up to 40 is like young. So maybe Imam looks someone who is some 30 years old. So this is the starting point for our reflection. So it shows that the youths must not think they have a marginal role. The youth must know that they have very central role in preparing, and then when Imam comes, in helping Imam alayhi salam. I share with you some of the things that we need to work on in order to be able to qualify ourselves for being, inshallah, among helpers of Imam alayhi salam before and after he comes. The very first thing that I am sure everyone would appreciate is that if we want to help Imam alayhi salam, we should ourselves be strong. Yeah? If I want to do something, for example, if I want to build a house, if I want to build a hospital, if I want, I don't know, to educate people, and you want to help me, so at least I should be hoping that you give me a hand, you give me some power, you give me something. Not that you yourself are in need of, you know, someone to awaken you, for example, someone to make you stand on your feet. So when it comes to helping Imam Mahdi, I should try to be myself someone who is strong. I don't mean physically strong. I mean someone who in his willpower, in iman, in determination, in taqwa, is able to have the basic requirements, at least. I'm not saying that you have to be arif, you have to be mystic, you have to be, for example, a great, you know, wayfarer, but at least to be muttaqi, especially not to do zulm, because zulm, doing zulm to any person, starting with yourself, with family, neighbors, strangers, even enemies, if we do zulm, we would not be in a position to give our hand to Imam alayhi salam. No one who is zalim, who is unjust, can help Imam in universal mission for establishing justice. So I need to strengthen myself in my taqwa, in doing my wajibat, in avoiding haram, and in particular, I would like to request you to work on justice. And for me, what comes very, very close to the justice, to the center of justice, which is not exactly justice, but it's very close to the center of justice, is fairness, insaf. Insaf is very important. It's one of those qualities that if someone has, you just want to be with them. Fairness, insaf. What is insaf? Insaf comes from nisf. Nisf means half. What does it mean? I can put it in this way. When there is something between me and another person, another party, maybe one individual, maybe one family, maybe one group, maybe a company, I don't know, another party. There is something between me and them. There is my right, there is their right, you know. So, is a case here. Insaf means not to try to bring their rights to your side by being biased, by being selfish. Insaf means to stand half the way between yourself and the other party, be impartial, be not biased, and look in an objective way. What is your right? What is their right? Maybe they are good people or bad people. Maybe they can present their case. Maybe they cannot present their case. If you are munsif, it doesn't make difference for you. It's impossible that you take even the least of their right to your side. Yes, you can forgive some of your right, if you like. Because you're right, you can forgive. But you cannot take from their right. A fair person, a just person, can be forgiving, can be generous with his own part, but not taking from the other part, is zulm. In other words, a fair person is the one that, if he's going to be judged between himself or another person, must not take his own side. And this is what me and you have to achieve in our life. Every day, many times, we judge between us and other people. Many times, every day, we judge. So we organize the court, we take the role of the judge, but between whom and whom? Between myself and someone else. And it is surprising or not surprising that most of the time we are winning. Other people are doing wrong things, are doing mistakes. I don't know why people don't appreciate me, why, you know, people have problem with me. All the things are in my favor, yes, because you have prepared the file and you have judged. So you are taking your side. If you want to help Imam Mahdi Ajjalallah Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif, and indeed to help yourself, you have to be equipped with justice and try to start with fairness. Between you and your siblings, be fair. Between you and your parents, be fair. Suppose you were in their position. Are you able to see their challenges? Are you able to see their side of the story? Or you can only see your part? You can only think about your interest? How many times I can give rights to other people? Very unfortunately, it's not very common. Insaf is very important. If there are people who are munsif, I am sure they are very much loved by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Mu'mineen who are munsif are very, very valuable. You cannot put actually value for them if they are munsif. So, the first thing is to strengthen ourselves with taqwa, with willpower, and especially equip yourself with insaf. Someone who is munsif is not going to do zulm to anyone. And then ma'rifa of Allah and ma'rifa of hujjah, of Allah and ma'rifa of community. In dua ahd, you know, we say to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, please send my salutations to Imam. And then we say, not just on my behalf, or not just on behalf of my parents and myself, on behalf of all mu'mineen and mu'minat fi mashariq al-ard wa magharibha, sahlaha wa jabalaha, barraha wa bahraha. All believers in the east, in the west, those who live in overseas, in islands, etc., all of them, we have to remember them every day.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Matin شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, and most importantly, the people in the region. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of the Subcontinent, we will discuss how minority Shias in Pakistan continue to live on the edge amid an alarming rise in targeted terrorist attacks. And we shall also take a look at deteriorating relations between Pakistan and the Taliban in the wake of fierce border clashes and violence.
A powerful explosion ripped through a Shia mosque in Pakistan's northwestern city of Peshawar during Friday prayers, killing at least 63 people and injuring 200 others. Described as the deadliest terrorist attack in several years, it targeted a historic mosque in a largely Shia neighborhood of Peshawar, sending shockwaves across the country. Responsibility for the ghastly attack was claimed by the Daesh terrorist group, which has stepped up its activities in the South Asian country in recent years with tacit support from the Pakistani Taliban.
On March the 4th, as worshippers assembled at Kocha Risaldar Mosque in centuries-old Kesahwani Bazaar of Peshawar for Friday prayers, a massive explosion tore through the mosque, leaving a trail of death and destruction. At least 63 people were killed and over 200 injured. Among the victims was prominent Shia cleric Allama Irshad Hussain Khalil. The youngest victim was a 6-year-old boy, Hussain Abbas, from Parachinar. It was the deadliest attack in Pakistan since July 2018, when a Daesh bombing killed 149 people in the city of Quetta. In Peshawar, a city of 2 million people near the border with Afghanistan, an attack of this scale had not been seen since 2014, when Tehrik Taliban Pakistan gunmen attacked an army school, killing 140 people, mostly students. As per eyewitness accounts, a motorcycle-borne assailant mowed down two policemen guarding the mosque before barging inside and detonating his suicide vest. There was dust and smoke everywhere as people ran frantically for their lives. Almost every household in the Shia neighborhood is mourning the loss of their loved ones. Police officials said there was no prior intelligence on the attack, but Prime Minister Imran Khan later admitted that intelligence agencies had all the information regarding the origin of terrorists. On Saturday, police investigators said the suicide bomber and his network had been identified.
Muslim-majority Pakistan has a bloodied history of sectarian violence and persecution of Shias. Violence perpetrated against the minority community by Takfiri terrorist groups has continued unabated for years, forcing many Shias to flee and take refuge in other countries. Those who chose to stay back continue to live on a razor's edge. Almost every city in the country today has a martyr's graveyard for Shias, bearing painful testimony to their unending ordeal. The graves keep piling up, and this time in Peshawar.
Pakistani Shias are among the most vulnerable and the bravest, prone to terrorist attacks. In recent years, groups such as Daesh, Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, Lashkar-e-Jangvi and Sepah-e-Sahaba have carried out a spate of targeted attacks on them, mostly in cities bordering Afghanistan. The latest attack in Peshawar, the capital and the largest city of Khyber Pashtunkhwa province, was claimed by the Daesh terrorist group, which launched its Pakistan chapter in May 2019. The group considers Shias heretics and has claimed many dastardly attacks in the country. Peshawar bombing, however, was the deadliest yet. The carnage in the northwestern Pakistani city has drawn widespread condemnation in and outside the country. Pakistan's President Arif Alvi and Prime Minister Imran Khan, in separate statements, expressed their condolences and vowed action against the perpetrators. Interior Minister Sheikh Rashid Ahmed termed the attack as an attempt to disrupt peace in the country. Imran Khan's government faces intense scrutiny over unchecked violence targeting minority Shias. Shia organizations across Pakistan, including Tehreek Nafaz Fiqh Jafariya, have held peaceful demonstrations over the tragic incident, demanding action against the perpetrators. Protests have spread to other countries as well, with calls in solidarity with Pakistani Shias growing louder.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Shehram Malik, researcher in cybersecurity and contemporary history. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Malik. As we've seen, violence targeting the minority Shia community continues unabated in Pakistan. So why have successive governments in Islamabad failed to crack down on these terrorist groups?
First thing I'd like to challenge you on is that the Shia community in Pakistan is not a minority. They are part of the very fabric of our society. Our founding father was Shia, Muhammad Ali Jinnah. He was belonged to the Ismaili Shia community. Some of our leaders, Zulfiqar Ali Bhutto, Shia, Asif Ali Zardari, who was president of Pakistan recently, he was Shia. Benazir Bhutto was Shia. So this concept that Shias are somehow a minority in Pakistan, we as Pakistanis do not recognize them as minorities. They are one of us. That's the first thing. This goes back to the time post-Iranian revolution when the jihad in Afghanistan started. Certain countries in the Middle East started funding mosques and madrasas within Pakistan and trying to stroke up this hatred not only towards the Americans but also towards the Shia community within the country. I mean, I'll give you my own example. I grew up, I am a Sunni, but I grew up about 10 meters from Imam Bargah. Nobody, none of my parents ever taught me to hate anybody. So this very idea is nonsense. The second thing is the state of Pakistan has been trying. The militant groups in southern Punjab, which were funded by the Middle East, like the big example is Lashkar-e-Jhangvi. They would target Shia Imam Bargahs, Shia mosques. That terrorist organization was completely wiped out by the Pakistani forces, by the Pakistani security apparatus in 2014. Then they found killers in the southern city of Karachi, where they were murdering Shia ulama and also Sunni ulama. And then their network was then basically propagating news within the media that one was done by the other. But the murders were actually performed by the same people, the same groups. And those groups were in fact trained in India. They had links to a guy who lives in England, by the way, not far from where I live, Altaf Hussein. So the state was complicit in the early 80s in allowing this hatred to actually fester and allow these groups to rise up. However, now the state is trying its best to wrap this up and fight these people. But unfortunately, now the foreign players have got involved. They're getting funding. They've got a safe haven in Afghanistan, in areas which the Taliban do not control at the moment. And that is where the struggle is. Now, the state is trying by stabilizing the Taliban government, because that's the only way they'll be able to progress. If there is stable Afghanistan, there will be stable Pakistan.
Now, Mr. Malik, the Peshawar mosque bombing was claimed by the Daesh terrorist group. Now, do you think the Daesh and Tehreek Taliban Pakistan and other groups are working in tandem?
Just before I answer that question, I am originally from Peshawar. About 2 months ago, I walked past that mosque. That mosque is in the old city of Peshawar, which is a very crowded area. There are a lot of shops in the area. It's an ancient part of the city. So these demons, it's basically an insult to human beings to call these people actually human. The Taliban and Daesh, the TTP, now I'm not talking about the Afghan Taliban here, TTP, the Tehreek-e-Taliban Pakistan, are directly linked to Daesh. A lot of their leaders, I mean, I can go through the names, but we do not have time at the moment. They have actually sworn allegiance to the leader of Tehreek-e-Taliban, Daesh, Khurasa. So they are working in tandem. All the splinter groups that had been defeated by the Pakistan military operation in the tribal, previously known as tribal areas, were pushed out. And now they're in Afghanistan. About 6 months ago, they actually got together and swore allegiance to one another, saying that now they will target Pakistan together. So it's a complicated situation. And then to top it all off, you've got foreign funding. I mean, keeping these groups going and providing them with arms, it's not something that just happened. They are getting funding. And I think at this point, I would also like to say that Pakistan also needs support from its neighbors, especially Iran, to hold those countries that fund these organizations to account. Because breaking up the very fabric of the Pakistani society can only happen by creating these chasms within the two major groups that live in Pakistan. 15% of the Pakistani population is Shia. So the most obvious chasm is this. And this is not something that's unknown within the modern fight by Muslims to keep them, their nations together. We've seen it in Iraq, we've seen it in Syria, we've seen it in Lebanon. So it's a complicated situation that can only be dealt with if we deal with it as a community together.
There you have it, Mr. Shehram Malik, researcher in cybersecurity and contemporary history. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see what people on social media had to say.
Tahir al-Qadri, a top Pakistani Sunni cleric, condemns the Peshawar mosque suicide bombing, saying those who spill the blood of innocents in the house of God cannot be Muslims. Founder and leader of Pakistan's MQM political party, Altaf Hussain, denounces the attack in Peshawar as naked terrorism, which he says raises question marks on the performance of security agencies. Rauf Kiasra, an author and columnist from Islamabad, calls the Peshawar tragedy painful, asserting that people at the helm must be held accountable for this massacre and their inefficiency.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Since the Taliban in a dramatic fashion swept back to power in Afghanistan last August, tensions between the group and Islamabad have grown. Pakistani authorities allege that the Taliban are allowing the Afghan territory to be used by militant groups to attack Pakistan. The group denies the charges, but is infuriated over the construction of a fence by Pakistan along the 2,700-kilometer border with Afghanistan, which has long been a bone of contention between the two sides.
On February the 24th, at least two people were killed and dozens injured in fierce border clashes between Afghanistan's Taliban and Pakistani troops. The firefight resulted from a dispute over the construction of a military checkpoint in a southwestern border area that divides Pakistan's Chaman and Afghanistan's Spin Boldak. Both sides traded accusations over the violence. Taliban spokesperson Zabiullah Mujahid claimed that Pakistani forces were the first to open fire, calling it regrettable. A Pakistani security official was quoted as saying that Taliban fighters made the first move and opened unprovoked fire at them. Thousands of people daily cross the border, mostly from Afghanistan. The Chaman Spin Boldak incident came weeks after intense clashes were reported at a northwestern border post in Khurram district. Five Pakistani soldiers were killed in the incident, claimed by Tehrik Taliban Pakistan militants allegedly operating from the Afghan territory. It prompted Pakistan's Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi to send a strongly worded message to the Taliban. He said if the group cannot address the concerns of Pakistan, no one will trust them and their promise of cutting ties to Al-Qaeda and other such groups. The statement raised eyebrows in Kabul, where the interim Taliban government has been vigorously campaigning for international legitimacy amid the worsening economic and humanitarian crisis.
The time-tested relations between Pakistan and the Afghan Taliban have developed strains in recent months owing to border skirmishes and disputes over the construction of fencing on the Durand Line, which divides the two neighboring countries. Pakistan has been erecting the fencing to prevent the infiltration of militants from Afghanistan. Taliban, however, doesn't recognize the border, a line adopted by successive governments in Kabul over the years. And now, the protracted border dispute threatens to turn allies into arch foes.
After their government was overthrown by the US-led military coalition in 2001, the top Taliban leadership took refuge in neighboring Pakistan. From their bases in Pakistan, they launched a full-scale armed movement to free Afghanistan from US occupation. The struggle ultimately bore fruit after 20 years, which many saw as a strategic triumph for Islamabad. 7 months on, cracks have already appeared in their relationship, mainly due to the long-standing dispute over the Durand Line. The de facto border created by British colonialists is considered by Afghans a historic mistake. Taliban have adopted the same line, refusing to accept it. Pakistan started fencing the porous border in 2014 to prevent cross-border attacks and smuggling. In recent months, there have been reports of the Taliban attempting to break the fencing in many areas. Taliban's Defense Ministry spokesperson in a statement in January said Pakistan had no right to fence the border and divide ethnic Pashtuns. Amid growing tensions between the two sides over the border fencing, there has also been an alarming uptick in violence, with dozens of military personnel killed in attacks on Pakistani army outposts along the border with Afghanistan. Most of these attacks have been claimed by the Pakistani Taliban, who feel emboldened by the Afghan Taliban's dramatic takeover in Kabul.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by political analyst Mr. Akib Mahmood. Welcome to the program, sir. Now, relations between the Taliban and Pakistan appear to have developed strains in recent months following some fierce border clashes. So, has the relationship reached a breaking point?
I don't think it's reached a breaking point because at the moment, the only government that is really engaging with them is the Pakistani government. So the Taliban are shrewd political operators, and they understand that they need to be accepted by the international community. And so I don't think they will put their relationship with the Pakistan government in any kind of jeopardy, especially when they consider that it was Pakistan who brought them to the negotiating table and negotiated the U.S. exit. It was Pakistan who helped them the most throughout the last 20 years and in terms of the U.S. exit from Afghanistan. So I don't think it's at breaking point. Yes, certainly relationships are strained, but they're not overly difficult at the moment. So there will be a diplomatic solution to this somehow.
Mr. Mahmood, Pakistani authorities allege that TTP militants are using the Afghan soil to launch attacks on Pakistan, but Afghan Taliban denies it. So what is the truth in your opinion?
The truth is that the TTP themselves were in a ceasefire with the Pakistan government after the Taliban took over. The Taliban acknowledged at the time that no one will be allowed to use Afghan soil against Pakistan, and they're committed to that. And that's where the ceasefire, that's what the ceasefire was born out of. They wanted Pakistan and the TTP to negotiate a deal of some sort and come to an understanding, because the TTP realized that the Taliban are now the major stakeholder in Afghanistan, and they wanted to be absorbed into the Taliban, the Afghan Taliban, and the Afghan Taliban wanted to ensure that the TTP was on the same page as them vis-a-vis Pakistan and not using Afghan territory against Pakistan. So that ceasefire ended in December of last year, and since then we've seen a steady sort of rise in intelligence-based operations against TTP militants and other militant groups that are based in Afghanistan, in Pakistani territory and places like that. So in the border areas, in the former tribal areas. So the truth is somewhere in between, that the Taliban, the TTP are in Afghanistan, and they are using it against Pakistan.
Now, Mr. Mahmood, let's talk about the construction of a fence by Pakistan on the Durand Line, which has also fueled tensions between the two sides. How do you look at this protracted dispute over the de facto border?
The dispute over the border, which is essentially an internationally recognized border and has been consistently for the last 100 or so years, the dispute arises from the fact that the Taliban, the base of the Taliban, is basically the Pashtun tribes of that border region, southern Afghanistan, eastern Afghanistan, and which is basically western and southwestern Pakistan. And those people, those Pashtun tribes, are split by that Durand Line. So while the Taliban would accept that it's a border, they would not accept it as a hard border. They would not accept it as the way that Pakistan is now fencing that border and creating a barbed wire border with extra security features to ensure no encroachment. So Pakistan is looking after its own security, especially after the last 20 years where Afghan territory has been used against Pakistan. Before, when the Taliban was in power in the 90s, that border was an open border. Anyone could come and go. It was very porous, and Pakistan had no security threat from there. But Pakistan cannot allow it to be used again, as it was in the last 20 years since the American invasion. And so Pakistan is fencing that. This has been discussed quite extensively with the Taliban, and there hopefully will be a diplomatic solution, as the Islamic Emirates have suggested that they will discuss this diplomatically and resolve the issue diplomatically. As far as the incidents of clashes on the border and stuff like that, you've got to understand that the Taliban is not a centralized organization at the moment. It has a lot of disparate organizations which have joined it, and some of them are more nationalist than others, and we'll be looking at the border fence as something which needs to be resisted by violence. So, some of those groups will need to be reined in by the Afghan Taliban leadership.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Aqib Mahmood for his precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Pakistan-based journalist Salim Shahid reports about the suspension of trade and other business activities between Pakistan and Afghanistan after border clashes between the two sides. Michael Kugelman, the senior associate at the Wilson Center, notes a drop in terrorist incidents after the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, but points to a surge in cross-border attacks from Afghanistan. A Pakistan-based journalist, Iftikhar Firdaus, cites the Pakistani military's media wing as saying that they strongly condemn the use of Afghan soil for militancy directed at Pakistan.
And that was our episode about the relentless persecution of minority Shias in Pakistan and the growing tensions between Pakistan and the Taliban over border skirmishes and violence. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant factor.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
امامت is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful.
Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned. There are some people who are dutiful towards the order of Allah. In fact, they act based on Allah's obligations. One good example is Prophet Moses. When he and his companions reached the sea and there was no way to escape the enemy, he was ordered by Allah to enter the sea. At first, they didn't know that the seawater will part and they will pass. The logical mind in such cases thinks that I will be drowned, so it's better not to risk. However, Prophet Moses and the people with him listened to the orders of Allah and went to the sea, and Allah saved them. Hazrat Ali Akbar, son of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, is another good example of dutifulness towards the orders of Allah. Such souls are great because they are rooted in faith.
قرآن کریم می‌فرماید و من یقاتل فی سبیل الله. این آیه از آیات مهمه.
In the Holy Quran, Surah An-Nisa, Ayah 4, we read, "And whoever fights in the way of Allah and then is slain, or he subdues the enemy, we shall soon give him a great reward." We as Muslims must feel dutiful towards the orders of Allah. Practicing Allah's obligations means to listen to His orders carefully and do them one after another. We are not allowed to act against them. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا